What we're going to be doing is, if this is your computer, we're going to be going in and setting up a proxy on your local box. And I'm going in here and I'm telling my browser to now send all information through this proxy. And then this proxy is going here. Then Dojo's going to go here and this. So in essence, what I'm doing is on my box, I'm running a monitoring component where I can intercept, see, and access all of the raw data that's going back and forth between the system. And then I can use this proxy to automate password guessing, password cracking, and other attacks on that system. So this is basically the scenario that we're creating within our environment. So the first thing after you try out a few, once again, I want to visually show you, and then the lab book takes you through this. You're going to go down here and set up your proxy. Then you're going to go click on the K, and you're going to go here, and you're going to type in Zed, which is your Zed attack proxy known as Zap. And we're now going to start this up on our system. So now this is going to go in and start up on our particular box. So you're going to accept the license agreement.
Did pop up. Where did you go, Zed?
Here we go. Now you're going to get this that's saying if you technically want this to work correctly, you got to set up a root certificate and import and do all that. So you can go in and we'll worry about that later. And then we go in now, and now when I go to Firefox, and I now type in John, and I type in a password of John, and I do submit, and now it doesn't work. Now if I go back here, and I go in and I look at the data, now notice, here I get the post that I just intercepted that now has the password, username of John, and password of John. So I just intercepted that connection that I typed here so I can actually view that information. So now I'm gathering the data back and forth. Then what we're going to have you do is now you can actually go here, right click, and we could now brute force the passwords on the system. So now I can go in and do a brute force attack where now I can go in and have Zed try all different passwords until I successfully break in to that environment, because instead of me manually typing in John and passing it, once my proxy intercepted the request form, I can now have Zed automate that, and literally I would just go in to where this password field is. I could highlight this, and then I can go in and pretty much have it try any other passwords here by fuzzing it, and then it'll randomly try passwords until it breaks into the site. So we can use these types of tools to do brute force attack vectors, and because a lot of these HMIs have shared or weak passwords, this is an easy way to be able to break in and compromise that environment. So that's going to be the second lab that we're going to work on. So if you go in and you turn to page 34, read through the text again, but essentially you're going to be doing what I just showed you, where you're going to be scrolling at the Samurai. You need to be in Samurai for this lab. You're going to go to the browser, show how it works. You're then going to set up your proxy, start up Zed, intercept connections, and then you're going to try to brute force the passwords on those devices. And once again, Tim and Graham and myself will be walking around if you need any help. But that's going to be our second lab. Now, I want to go in and give you 20 minutes to work on this lab, but it's 10 after 12, and we have lunch at 12:15. So what I'm going to do is we're going to go in and start back up at 1:45, And between now and 1:45, I want you to have lunch and do the lab. And we want you to work on this lab to see how you can spoof, attack, and break into accounts on the system. And then we'll start back up with the lecture at 1:45. So in our second lab, you got a chance to go in and see how fuzzing techniques work, where you actually try different passwords to try to guess and gain access. Now remember, these types of tools are based on the assumption that the password is somewhat reasonable and can be guessed. If you go in and start using one-time passwords or 15-character passwords, letters, numbers, and special, this type of attack could take a really, really long time. Also, if you have account lockout in play, where after 5 failed logins in a 30-minute period, you lock the account, this technique will no longer work. Which what's interesting is, in IT environments, these types of tools are becoming less and less valuable because we're going in our web interfaces and other areas, and we're using one-time passwords, complexity checks, and lockouts. However, because industrial control systems have that 10 to 15-year lag, these tools that are becoming obsolete in IT arenas are still extremely effective in control system environments because many control systems have easily guessable passwords that do not change, and many of the web interfaces do not have account lockout in place. So this is an area where we see differences that can actually be a benefit in some of these tools, because stuff that doesn't work in a traditional can still be very, very effective because of the lower grade security that's typically implemented from an ICS perspective. So now that we've gone in and looked at how we do our basic password cracking, now let's go and look a little deeper into some of the other web-based attacks or input level attacks. Remember, we have some application that's taking input from a client and sending it to some server to process it, which means if there's not proper error checking and I can manipulate this input and send it here and get something bad or unusual to happen, I can gain control of this system, which means an adversary can now have control of an HMI, an engineering workstation, or any other device that's in that supervisory control network. So some of the other methods of web-based attacks that we're going to look at is we've covered the authentication. We're going to look at SQL injection, cross-site scripting, cross-site forgery, and some of these local file attack vectors that are out there. Essentially, if you can bypass the authentication, you can gain access to that facility. One way is going in and being able to steal the credentials that we've talked about. So we've showed you how you can guess the password, brute force the password to be able to get in. That's one way of gaining in. The other way is going and trying to bypass or get around the authentication altogether. So figuring out or manipulating the code so this way you don't ever have to type in a user ID or password. One of the ways that we do this is by hacking the session ID value of our website. In order to understand how this works, we have to take a quick journey in understanding HTTP. HTTP is the Hypertext Transfer Protocol. It is the service that's utilized by the web that runs on TCP port 80 as the well-known port. HTTP was built to be an object request brokering system to allow people to access objects from a server to share and correlate and coordinate on information. HTTP was built to be stateless. What that means is when you make connections to a web server to request objects by your browser, HTTP does not track whether it's coming from one person, 5 people, or 20 people. So if you have 5 different users all accessing objects and requesting information from that web server, by default, because HTTP is stateless, that web server has no idea whether those requests are from one person, 5 people, or 20 people. And honestly, it doesn't care because it wasn't built to keep track of user behavior. It was meant just to provide information and details. So if you're surfing the web and you're just downloading documents, RFCs, reference information, the stateless nature of HTTP works perfectly fine. Where does the stateless nature of HTTP create problems for us? Whenever we're going in and doing authentication, e-commerce, online banking, HMI logins, wherever we need to log in and remember the state of the user and the fact that they authenticated is where the stateless nature of HTTP is going to cause a problem. Here's the issue. If we didn't figure out a way to add state in at the application level and you wanted to authenticate to a web-based interface, what would you have to do with default native HTTP? You would have to provide your user ID and password on every single page. So every single page, you would have to keep entering in your user ID and password for every request, and you would have to be re-authenticated for every object request, because otherwise HTTP is not going to remember what you're doing. Hopefully we all recognize the fact of doing that would be inefficient, would be very frustrating to the user, and would not be a good way to communicate. Therefore, because HTTP is stateless, we have to add state in at an application level, which means after you provide credentials, user ID and password to the application, and you successfully authenticate, what does the application do to add in state? It generates a session ID value that it passes back to you. Then every time you authenticate, it adds the session ID back. So now what you're doing is between you and the server, you're passing the session ID each time. So now every time I connect, my browser behind the scenes is passing that session ID back to the server. And that session ID is equivalent to my user ID and password. That session ID is authenticated Eric. So now because my browser is passing it, I now am authenticating each time behind the scenes. So I don't have to re-enter in my user ID and password. What's the problem? That session ID in many systems is only 5 or 8 characters. It's pseudo-randomly generated, and it could potentially be guessed, which means if I want to break into your account, I can do one of two things. I can break your user ID and password, or I can crack your session ID. If a session ID is only 8 characters and sequentially generated, and passwords are 12 characters somewhat randomly generated, which is an easier target? The session ID. So now what I can do is I can go in and utilize tools like WebScarab or others that will go in and guess your session ID. And if I could figure out the session ID, it's equivalent to your user ID and password. And now I can bypass your authentication together to be able to use that session ID in order to break in to that system. Because session IDs are normally passed via cookies, hidden form elements, or in the URL field, they're pretty easy to intercept, modify, or alter. So that becomes another effective technique for breaking in and compromising HMIs or supervisory control systems. Then we get into SQL injection. When you enter in a user ID and password, what's happening? What's happening is that username and password that you enter is getting passed to the server and is getting embedded within a standard query language statement that searches a database to authenticate you. So your server is going to have a database that contains username and passwords. And when you enter in those values and pass it to the server, it's going to issue a SQL statement that says select from the database where the user ID value equals the username and the password that you entered. So SQL is going to search each record in the database and see if it's a true statement. If the user ID and password do not match, it generates false. And if the user ID and password do match, it generates true. Whenever you get a true response to a SQL statement, you're given access to that information, and then you can log in as that user to access the information. Well, if I know that my values that I type in the username and password field are being embedded into a SQL statement, I can inject additional data to cause that SQL statement to behave differently. So if we take a look at how this is occurring, you have the client, which has a username and a password. These values are going to get passed to the server, and the server is going to take those values and insert them into a SQL statement that says select from the user database the user ID value where user name equals blank and password equals blank. So now what happens is it's going to take this value and embed it in there, and this value embedded in there, and it's going to search the database on the system. So if I'm playing by the rules and I enter in my username of ecol and my password of pass 1234, because remember we want to have letters and numbers and we want to have 8 characters, so very secure password there. What's going to happen? It's going to go to the database and it's going to look at every record. And for the first record, it's going to say, does the username and password match these values? No, 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 no. When it gets to my account, what is it going to say? True, and I'm given access to the system. So this is how it normally operates and functions. Now, what if I'm a clever attacker? What could I do? I could go in and instead of entering in my real username, what if I entered in single quote or username equals admin? Now what's going to happen is whatever you enter always gets appended with single quotes automatically by the system. So now it's going to generate a SQL statement that looks like this. Now what is it going to do? Now it's going to say select from the user database the user ID where the username is blank or the user ID equals admin. So now it's going to go to each record, and any record that has a blank username or a user ID of admin, it's going to generate a return and dump those values on the screen for me. So now I'm starting to go in and manipulate the database because there's not error checking done, so I can insert additional commands in play. Now to fully understand this, the semicolon is end of SQL terminator. So I'm terminating the statement, so it's the end of the statement. Why am I putting a dash dash afterwards? Excellent. Dash dash is a comment. Why am I putting a comments at the end? Excellent. I don't want to generate an error message. Error messages are often spotted by security folks and trigger a problem. So if I just did this, what's going to happen? End of SQL command, and it's going to issue an end password, which is an incorrect SQL statement, generate an error. That's an anomaly, and that's going to trigger a problem on the system. But now by commenting out everything else, what's going to happen now? It's a clean SQL statement, and no error is generated on the system. So that's why we go in and do the dash dash to comment out the rest of the statement to minimize any other attack vectors from being present. Now, this is okay, but I'm greedy. I don't want just blank or usernames of admin. I want everything. So what is my attack vector going to be? My attack vector, I'm going to enter in single quote or 1 = 1 semicolon dash dash. Now what happens? Now it's going to go in and it's going to say select from the user database the user ID where the username is blank. Or 1 = 1. Now watch what happens. I go to the first record. Is the username blank? No. Does 1 = 1? True. Dump the record. Next record. Does 1 = 1? True. Dump the record. So by going in and putting an equality in the system, I am now forcing back a return, and I can use that to either log in and or access records that I shouldn't have access to. Now, this is going to dump the database. What if I want to get into the box? What if I know there's a valid account called John? What am I going to do? I'm going to actually switch this around a little. Now I'm going to enter in a username of John. And now down here, I'm going to enter in single quote or 1=1?" Now watch what happens. Now it goes in and it says select from the user database the user ID where the username is John and the password is blank or 1=1. So now when I go through the first record, is the user ID John? No, 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 no. When I get to John's record and the username matches John, what is it going to do now? It's going to look at the password and say, is the password blank or does 1=1? Because 1=1 is true, we now created a true statement for John. And what's going to happen? I'm going to be logged in as John into the box without knowing their password. So that's how we go in and compromise attacks from a SQL injection perspective, is by taking advantage of the fact that proper error checking is not done on the system. And then I'm able to send a qualities into that system to take over and log in, even though I don't know the password. Cross-site scripting is where you go in and an attacker has embedded JavaScript in a link. So everything that you're sending to a remote site is also going to an adversary site. And this is an enhancement to hijacking. What is the original way if I have an adversary and I want to go in and compromise all your information that you're entering into the system? One way of doing it is I can go in and let's create a new scenario. You have your web browser open, or let's say you get an email and you have some URL embedded here. What's the first generation level attack? I put sans.org here, but my aref is actually the evil site. So that would be first generation where this is sans, but my aref, which says where I'm really going, is actually sent to evil. So now whenever I click on sans, I'm going to the evil site. Simple, easy. What's the problem with this? If you hover over, if you sniff or you do anything, you know you're going to the wrong location. So what cross-site scripting does is I go in and I make my aref sans. So now when you click on this, you're going to sans. But I now go in and I add an A script that captures everything you type and sends all that information to an evil site. So now what happens is when you type at the keyboard, everything you type at the keyboard and you hit enter, it goes to both sites. So now you're going to the realsans.org, but I in essence put a background sniffer that's capturing all your keystrokes and via scripting is sending it to an alternative site. So now the problem is you're sending your user ID and password to the adversary, but if you're looking at the connections and where you're going to the real SAN server, so it's much harder to detect and much harder to figure out and find what's happening and what's occurring in boxes. This is one of the favorite techniques that's used a lot in our APT spear phishing attacks, where we're going to go in and send you a legitimate looking email. You think it came from your boss or a real site. You see that it's going to your corporate server, so you type in and hit enter. But in reality, there's a scripting component that's running that's redirecting it to an alternative location on your system. Now, cross-site request forgery is where you can now go in and trick a user to execute information connections on your local box. If you go in and take a look at this, if you enter in this command, Google search Samurai STFU, what do you expect to happen? You're going to go to the Google site and you're going to go in and search for Samurai STFU. Now, what if you go in and you click on this? What's going to happen is you're going to go to your HMI power for your power utility. You're going to disconnect meter 34599. So by clicking on that, you are actually now going in and sending an actual command to one of the field devices to disconnect it, turn it off, or change it. So via the web, you can actually go in and issue requests, updates, or information. Now, what if I know information about your site? I know the location of a meter or something I want to target via reconnaissance. What if I go in and when you connect to my website and you click on a legitimate link, what if I embed this as a hidden link so this now runs behind the scenes on your system without you realizing it? That's what cross-site forgery requests are. Cross-site scripting is where I'm taking data locally from your system and pushing it to an evil site. Cross-site request forgery is the other direction. I'm going to an evil site that I don't know is evil, and it's pushing commands back to my system to execute and run on the box. Now, here's the scary part. I can issue a cross-site forgery request at connection time to a website, which means if I can just get you to connect to my evil site, you don't have to do anything. Just by doing your SYN-SYNAC act to port 80 on that server, I can instantly at connection time push down a cross-site forgery and break in or compromise your system. So how would an adversary force you to connect their site? They would go in and they would hack the Google keywords. Do you realize that you can go in Google and see what the most common search terms are for different entities, different units, or different organizations? And do you realize you can go in, and if you're an attacker, you can use stolen credit cards, of course, but if you pay Google money, you can appear higher in the search list. So if I know that your company is doing a lot of work with Siemens S7 controllers, and you might be searching on that term, what could I do? I can use stolen credit cards to be able to buy up my hit rate for my evil site. So when you search on Siemens S7 security, I now pop up as one of the top two or three links. And now when you click on it, you connect, you see some basic data there. It's not really important. So you go to the next one, but guess what? You're done. Because as soon as you connected, I pushed a command to take over, perform action, or perform problems on your system. So that's the issue on the cross-site request forgery, is I trick you in some way, shape, or form to connect to a site that's not legit, and then it can push down requests to your system to cause certain activity to occur. Then we can also go in and do local and remote file inclusions on your system. When you go and you access sites, you can actually pull files or information from servers via the web. So you can use the web almost as a front end for moving files back and forth, both locally and remotely from your system. So I can have a website that when I connect, it goes to your historian. It pulls log files from the historian, copies them to your system, and loads them up on your browser so you can view the logs and see what's happening. Once again, because the web is a front end for file access requests, an adversary can also go in, hijack, and take over that, so now they can read random files from your system. Yes, I can use it as a data discovery tool, but if I'm going against the Unix box, what if I go in and use it to read your Etsy password and Etsy shadow? This is where your user IDs are, and this is where your encrypted passwords are. So now I can get your username and encrypted passwords and be able to correlate it together to be able to analyze and figure out ways into your system. So you can see there's a lot of different ways of getting into the box. It's great that I showed you at a high level how SQL injection attack works, but we'd rather you see firsthand how that actually functions. So if you go in and you turn to page 42 in your lab book, remember in our lab book now, so we're switching from 410.2 to our lab book, and if you go to page 43, we're going to actually have you go in and go back to our test page, and we're going to have you launch some SQL attacks against that web browser. Now, I'm going to have you try a bunch of different requests here. So we're going to go in, and I'll try some different commands. I'm going to purposely enter in something that's not going to work, and I'll show you why. It didn't work, but what did I just get? I got the server to generate error messages. Error messages are extremely valuable to an adversary because what did I just get? I got the full SQL statement. Now I know exactly how it's generating it. It's going to select anything from our accounts where the username is what I entered and the password is PPP. So now I see, now I know where my input is sitting. And now I can more strategically craft my attack vector. So in a lot of cases, when you do web app pen testing or trying to break into web interfaces, you're purposely generating errors to get the server to give you details and insight into how it's working and how it's operating. So now that I know how the SQL statement works, now I can go in and we can go back here. And now I'm going to enter in single quote or 1=1 semicolon dash dash. Now, very important. In order for this to work, you have to put a space after the dash dash. So watch, I'm not going to put a space and it will generate an error message. But if I now come back and I do the same command and I put a space there, and now I enter in. Now I'm logged in. Now I went in and did a equality to go in. The reason why the space is needed is because dash dash with a space is the comment. Without a space, it's not viewed as a comment and generates an error message on our system. So in our books, it's very hard to show a space. So we actually have a bubble that says, make sure you enter a space. But I wanted to show you what happens if you don't. So if you forget to put it in and it doesn't work, you know why that didn't work. And then if you go back and put a space, it's then going to work and log us into that specific box. So what we'd like you to do now is go to page 43. Of course, read the notes. And I'm going to have you systematically work up to this point. I want you to type in some A's and see how it works. We're then going to type some variations. And then when we get to page 46, you're going to do the actual attack and see how it works. So I'm going to have you generate a few error messages, and then we're going to actually have you log in as different users on the system so you can see how this attack actually works and occurs in a real environment. So let's go ahead. It's 2:20. Let's take 20 minutes to work on this lab. So we'll start back at 2:40, and then when you come back at 2:40, we'll go in and start our next section. So what I just want to do, just so we can wrap up, is in this section, we talked about a lot of attack vectors against HMI. We started off by looking at going after the human factor and socially engineering that person with a variety of techniques. We then went after the web interface, going in, looking at guessing passwords, going after session IDs, and trying to attack SQL database commands by setting up equalities to be able to dump information within our system. Once we go in and finish that lab, we're then going to look at various attacks on control servers. So let's now break for the lab. We'll give you 20 minutes to work on that lab. Go through our third lab where you get to try out and see how a real SQL injection attack really works. The trick is make sure you read the notes, because we're going to take you through the logic, and I just showed you the end state of how it actually works within your box. As always, myself, Tim, and Graham will be walking around. Now that you've all got a chance to do SQL injection attacks, remember that if you decide to use those attacks against your bank to get additional money or benefits, the commission for Tim and myself is 10%. And we'll split the 10. It's not 20. It's 5 for each of us. So just remember, we'll give you the offshore banking account numbers that you can transfer that money to. But we just need a 10% balance there for that to work. All kidding aside, back to what we talked about this morning. Please do not try these techniques against sites in which you don't have permission or authorization. Most banks are properly protected against this. But believe it or not, even in the year 2013, we periodically run across financial institutions that have online banking websites that are vulnerable to this exact attack, where you can actually gain access to records, information, and accounts. And this year, we've done many pen tests against banks, and 3 of them, we were able to do SQL injection attacks that, if we wanted to, could have caused financial impact for people who had accounts at that financial institution. So this is not a old attack that only works in the control system environment. This unfortunately works in the real world with e-commerce, banking, and other vendors. So remember, only try this with explicit written permission. And the reason why we're having you do everything locally for these last few labs is these last two labs are technically hacking. You're technically hacking, breaking in and gaining access to resources that do not belong to you. But because we're doing it in a lab on your local box in a controlled environment, it's perfectly okay. But as soon as you do it over the internet against sites or locations, even your company site, in which you don't have explicit permission, you could be getting into a lot of legal trouble really, really quickly. So just be super careful with some of these methods. I know they sound simple and they seem simple, but unfortunately they are effective ways of gaining unauthorized accesses to resources that you probably shouldn't be accessing. Excellent. So the question is, what are the countermeasures to go in and prevent these types of attacks? The long answer is you need to come tomorrow, because that's what book 3 is all about. The shorter answer, and I'll give to you, is to fill that there's two approaches. The simple approach that most banks and e-commerce sites do is they filter out known bad SQL commands. So they filter out single quote, semicolon, colon, and double quote. If you don't believe me, try it on Google, Amazon, or any of those sites. If you go to any of those major sites and you try putting a semicolon, a colon, or a single quote in your password, they will come back and say, these characters are not allowed to be in passwords. Please re-enter your password. So the way most of the e-commerce sites do it today, even the big ones and the large banks, is they filter out known bad SQL commands, which is going to be your single quote, your double quote, your colon, and your semicolon. So you go into those sites and try entering them in, and they will not allow it. That's the simple solution that most of them use. The better, more scalable, but slightly more complex solution is figure out the character set that's allowed for the input field and only allow those characters into that area. So if you're entering in a username, it should only be upper or lowercase numbers. If you're entering in an age, it should only be numbers. So you're now filtering out based on the characters that are allowed. That more scalable approach works good for fixed fields like username, age, and others. What's always the problem with passwords? You have two competing objectives. On the one hand, I want my passwords to be very complex with lots of different characters. So the one hand would say, I want my passwords to have lots of special characters, lots of numbers, lots of letters, because it's much harder to guess. The competing objective to that is, but wait, if we now have SQL characters that make it more complex, semicolon, colon, double quotes, things like that, that's going to also allow injection attacks on there. So the balance between it is for password fields is to allow all complexity except those restricted values. That's why most of the sites go with that easier option of just filtering out known bad SQL and allowing any other character to be in your password. And like I said, you can try that with most e-commerce sites. Try putting a semicolon in your password. Almost all of them will not allow you to do it for the reasons we just laid out from a SQL injection perspective. Any other questions or comments on HMI attacks, web-based attacks, web-based exploits? Excellent. Then let's go ahead and jump in to attacks on control servers. Now we're going against the actual servers that are running in your supervisory control zone or the servers that are managing or controlling your field unit. In many, many cases today, a lot of the hardware that you're purchasing is actually running on a common operating system. A lot of the hardware that you would purchase from vendors is actually running a reduced kernel set of Linux, and more are starting to deploy Windows, typically XP or 2000, in their configuration settings in those devices. What's the problem? A lot of those systems have a default install, and you can't modify, alter, or change it once it's in production. What's the problem with the default install? It tends to have a lot of extra things running on it. Let me explain, real simple, the life of an operating system vendor. If you're Microsoft, if you're Red Hat, if you're producing any operating system, what is your ultimate goal that you're trying to achieve? Make your customers happy. I mean, that's pretty much the ultimate goal, because happy customers buy more products, spend more money, and drive up revenue and profitability, which is good. What makes customers happy? When things work. Which means, if I want my customers to be happy, and customers are happy when things work, if I'm giving you a default install of my operating system, do I want everything turned on? Or do I want everything turned off? Well, let's look at it. If everything is turned on, you do a default install, everything works, and you're happy. If everything's turned off and you do a default install, nothing works. You have to do a lot of custom configuration to get things working. You get frustrated and you get unhappy. Therefore, based on that logic that I just laid out, how do you think many vendors configure their operating systems today? With the superset of services and functionality that most organizations need, because this way everything works out of the box and you have a higher chance of being happy. While that's great for functionality, what's the problem with security? The more things that are running, the more unhappy we are with security, because the greater the chance that there's exposures, vulnerabilities, and problems.